Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, April 24th, 2025, and our friend Alex Craner is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you for having me, Nima. Good to be with you, and greetings to everyone out there.
Alex, let's talk about what's going on in Ukraine. It seems that as time goes by, everything is getting much more complicated for Donald Trump. Here is what he said in terms of what he's dealing with right now.
Is ready, and I think we have a deal with Russia. We have to get a deal with Zelensky, and I hope that Zelensky, I thought it might be easier to deal with Zelensky. So far it's been harder, but that's okay. It's all right.
But
I think we have a deal with both. I hope they do it, because I'm looking to save, and you know, we spend a lot of money, but this is about a lot of humanity. This is the worst. I get the pictures, the satellite pictures. I've never seen anything like it.
When he's talking about the satellite pictures, everybody would know that he's talking about the casualties on the part of Ukrainians. And go ahead, Alex.
Well, I wonder if he got any satellite pictures from Gaza or from Rafah. Then he would see something much, much worse. But okay. Look, I think that the situation in Ukraine is a mess, obviously, but it's winding down to a close. At least the active war fighting part is drawing to a close, and I think that Zelensky regime is going to fall. It's a matter of time. I don't quite understand. Well, maybe I do understand, but you know, I think it's very strange that Zelensky is being as abrasive and as confrontational with Trump and his government when they are the only force in the world, the only military force in the world that can save his regime. I think it's very indicative that Zelensky's loyalties lie with some other force in the world. I think that's the City of London. And that he's very frustrated with the fact that he is no longer getting the unquestioning blank checks from the United States, unlimited supplies of arms and money and so forth. And so he is he's responding very impulsively. And I think that his policies are crafted in London. And he's doing as they tell him. And London has its own interests with respect to Ukraine, which are their interests, not the American interests, not the Western interests, not the European interests. And they are obviously trying to find ways to keep the United States committed to a Western-aligned regime in Ukraine, whether Zelensky or whoever might come after him. But the whole name of the game is keeping control of Kiev, retaining control of the Black Sea. And let's say that they need to keep the beachhead, you know, keep the place that they can use again in the future to destabilize Russia in whatever way that they can.
Yeah. Alex, the Times reported that the United Kingdom and France stepped back from troop deployment plans in Ukraine. When this idea of sending troops, peacekeepers to Ukraine, it was so absurd from the get-go. But you see, when you see the whole process, you see they're making some sort of argument to make some sort of chaos and then backing down. It's some sort of gain on their part. We know that Donald Trump, as Marco Rubio was talking about, J.D. Vance was talking about, they want to get out of Ukraine as soon as possible. But this came on the part of London, France. They're trying to do everything, making new sort of issues for negotiations as they were promised. They had promised to do this before. Here is what J.D. Vance said. J.D. Vance said,
A very explicit proposal to both the Russians and the Ukrainians, and it's time for them to either say yes or for the United States to walk away from this process. We have engaged in an extraordinary amount of diplomacy, of on-the-ground work. We've really tried to understand things from the perspective of both the Ukrainians and the Russians. What do Ukrainians care the most about? What do the Russians care the most about? And I think that we've put together a very fair proposal. We're going to see if the Europeans, the Russians, and the Ukrainians are ultimately able to get this thing over the finish line. Again, I feel pretty optimistic about it. I think everybody has been negotiating in good faith, but it's now time, I think, to take, if not the final step, one of the final steps, which is at a broad level, the party saying, we're going to stop the killing. We're going to freeze the territorial lines at some level close to where they are today. And we're going to actually put in place the kind of long-term diplomatic settlement that hopefully will lead to long-term peace.
Yeah. Do you feel that Zelensky has a substantial role in what's going on?
Well, Zelensky does have a substantial role. The only problem is that Zelensky doesn't have sovereignty in Ukraine. You know, he's a puppet, and he's a puppet of external forces. And I think that the most essential aspect of this war, obviously, is economic. It's not, you know, I don't know if there's anybody left that still believes that this has anything to do with freedom and democracy. This is clearly about resources, Ukraine's resources, but more so Russia's resources, and using the hegemony over Central and Eastern Europe to defend the hegemony over the Eurasian landmass. That has been the game of the empire for the last two centuries. The United States has been a major part of this, and there are many vested interests in the United States that are still committed to this, that would still want to see Zelensky's regime succeed, retain power, defeat Russia, and, you know, they don't, I mean, defeat Russia and Ukraine, you know, force them to withdraw. I think that their Christmas list obviously includes ejecting Russia from the Black Sea altogether, you know, from Crimea. And now this is all very much in jeopardy. But because there are powerful vested interests in the United States that are still committed to this project, the Trump administration cannot openly say, we actually think we get a much better deal by aligning ourselves with Russia, and so we're going to drop this Ukraine project altogether and walk away. So, you know, they have to kind of wrap it in something that is acceptable to the U.S. public. They have to, it has to be, they can't talk about the economic aspect. They can't talk about the scramble for resources. So they have to talk about peace and humanitarian aspects and so forth. But, you know, there's clearly now a fault line emerging between the U.S. interests and the European interests. And, you know, the Zelensky has signed over in January the bulk of Ukraine's resources and infrastructure capital to British interests. And the Europeans, as far as I can judge from what Macron and his ministers are saying, the French bankers, they want to fund the reconstruction of Ukraine, and then you know, French corporations taking up the lead role in this, and they want to use the 200 plus billion of Russian assets that are still frozen in European banks. The United States is kind of trolling them in this sense that they are they're still pressuring Zelensky government to sign over Ukraine's resources to the United States, but they're forcing him into an unacceptable agreement, an agreement that is so draconian that it's obvious that Zelensky's government will reject it, and the agreement is covering the same assets that the Brits already secured for themselves with their 100-year partnership signed on 16th January. So the Americans are giving themselves a face-saving way out. And now, you know, we've come to the juncture where they're saying, all right, we tried everything we could, and now we're walking away. At the same time, they have continued negotiations with Russia, which, again, this economic aspect of them isn't widely discussed, but Vladimir Putin did say that Russia has a lot more resources than Ukraine does, and Russia already controls the bulk of everything that's valuable in Ukraine. You know, the Donbas used to account for something like 80% of Ukraine's GDP, and that's now largely under Russian control. And Putin has said, we very much welcome other nations to join us in developing this and exploiting these resources. So explicitly, the United States is welcome. And so that's, 10, 12 trillion worth of Ukraine's resources, plus 75 to 90 trillion of Russian resources. And then, you know, the United States also doesn't have to shoulder the cost of providing security for all this. And so it's an offer with much greater upside for the United States and virtually no downside. Whereas being the security guarantor for Zelensky's government has a massive downside risk, meaning, you know, the United States would have to provide the troops and the weaponry and the treasure to upkeep the Ukraine's government at risk of ending up in a war against Russia in the part of the world where Russia has the escalatory dominance. Even this was clear even to Barack Obama in 2014, which is why he declined to escalate the conflict back then. And so from that point of view, the choice for the United States is crystal clear, but it's not something that you can just lay out publicly and say, this is why we're doing it. It all has to be wrapped in human rights, humanitarian issues, peace, law and order, international, you know, all those nice things. And so I think that the Trump administration is very carefully maneuvering their way out while at the same time discussing cooperation with Russia on future things, on future projects, on economic development, on trade. And they give it away because they say we're discussing bigger issues than just Ukraine.
Alex, Financial Times yesterday reported that Russia has agreed on freezing the front line, which was shocking for me because you see no other outlet reporting on that. And you don't see it on CNN, BBC, MSNBC, and nobody reported on that. And is that possible for Russia if we assume that? Because in my opinion, Russia is not acceptable for Russia to freeze the front line because they're not just totally on the front line is not at the border of these four regions that are part of Russia right now, because Russia wants something beyond that to be a safe zone, a buffer zone.
I think that is possible because Russia has defeated Ukraine and Russia will dictate the terms of the armistice. And I think that in the terms of the armistice, they will ensure that they're able to administratively dominate the rest of Ukraine. You know, I don't know exactly how this is done, but I expect that, you know, there will be future elections in Ukraine. Russia will surely set up conditions on, you know, that there has to be a reform of the media, that all these parties that that Zelensky banned will have to be re-legalized, reinstated, that there will have to be a period of maybe a national unity government, and then, you know, the new elections. The Russians will exert pressure to bring all of the, you know, war criminals to justice. So there will be a continuing purge of the neo-Nazi element from Ukraine. And I think that in this way, without having to fight a war, Russia will be able to reassert itself and draw Ukraine back into its orbit and have a government in Kiev that will realign with Russia and loosen its ties to the West. And so in that sense, Russia gains control over all of Ukraine, again, without necessarily having to push the border militarily. And I think that part of the terms of the armistice will be probably 100% complete withdrawal of all Ukraine's forces from all four regions. So when they say we're going to freeze the front line, I think that what they're saying is we can stop fighting at these lines, but in the peace agreement, you will agree to completely withdraw your troops from all four regions that are now officially part of Russia, as far as the Russians are concerned.
But the buffer zone, I think that would be crucial, so much important for Russia to think of.
Yes.
There has to be some sort of definition in any sort of Ukrainian settlement. That buffer zone, yes. What would that be? It's going to be part of the Odessa, Nikolaev going up to Kharkov, or it's going to be the whole region?
But I think more importantly than the buffer zone, because what buffer zone is a geographic concept. I think that they need to prevent Western powers, particularly Great Britain, from controlling the government in Kiev, controlling the ports, because if they have control of the ports, they will continue to use it to bring in weaponry, to ship in troops, to effect an opium war against Russia, because they will try to use it to smuggle drugs into Russia. You know, opium war has been one of the main tools of foreign policy of Great Britain for 200 years now, and you know that can greatly destabilize any nation, and it's a problem for Russia, because Ukrainians are, you know, largely Russian speakers. Many of them have family in Russia. So you can't prevent the people from going in and out. So there's always going to be, Russia will always be a soft target if somebody has political control of the government in Kiev. So they will always have this vulnerability to being destabilized from Ukraine, unless they have control over their government and their system of law and order. And then, you know, let's not forget, the United States has had, I don't know, maybe they still have, a number of biolabs in Ukraine close to the Russian borders. According to the Pentagon themselves, Victoria Nuland conceded that they had 46 or 48, I forget the exact number, but there are many. So there's also the vulnerability to biological attacks in the future. So I think that there's no question that whether militarily or administratively, Russia has to take full control of Ukraine. And, you know, with the United States on their side, they might not need anymore to fight it out by force. It could be a political process. I think that Ukraine is crawling with Russian spies and Russian assets. I think that will continue to make it very, very difficult for the Western interests to defend their control of Ukraine. Because, you know, like, let's say French and British troops land in Odessa. I guarantee you there will be many people in Odessa who will provide the exact location of where these troops are to the Russians, who will visit with Mr. Kinzhal or something like that, you know. So it's going to be a political struggle for control of Ukraine. But if the Russians succeed to get the Americans on their side, then I think they no longer need to do it with the force of arms.
Alex, we had peace talks in London, which was collapsed because Ukraine rejected, as they're reporting on, rejected to talk about territorial negotiations, to talk about some sort of the way that Russia sees the eastern part of Ukraine. How do you really believe that? Is it really Zelensky and his people behind this? Or because we had the same thing coming out of France. Macron's office said that territorial integrity of Ukraine is non-negotiable. And how you talk about Europe, you said that there is substantial difference between United States and Europe, but who's Europe? Is that just United Kingdom and France, or maybe Germany? How about the other countries? Do they have anything to say?
I think it's predominantly United Kingdom and France. And I think that Germany is kind of teetering because the popular pressures are pushing the country away from Project Ukraine, while the CDU, CSU, the Greens, you know, these increasingly unpopular political factions are still committed to the Project Ukraine. But if you look at who they are, you know, they are all somehow alumni of the European banking, of the Western banking interests. You know, Friedrich Merz is a former BlackRock guy, and I think that this is the project of European banking oligarchies. This is not the project of European people. But the problem is that the European banking oligarchies have they're very powerful, because by controlling the flow of credit and money and being able to sanction certain countries and exert pressure on certain politicians, even up to assassinations, they control the political process, even though most of the public is opposed. And so there's no let up, there's no compromise, which means that the situation is getting increasingly polarized to the point where many people, I think, who understand what's going on, think that there's a real chance that we will have civil wars in Britain, in France, and in Germany, and maybe in other countries. Beyond that, you know, the Netherlands is very strongly committed to Project Ukraine, Denmark is, and the Baltic states. And I'm not sure where that comes from, but again, I think that they are, you know, very much dependent on the flow of cash from Brussels and from London, you know, not being sanctioned. Look at what is going on with Hungary, with Slovakia, even with Serbia, who's not part of the EU. There's always huge pressure on them to commit to Project Ukraine impose and maintain sanctions on Russia, to not go to Russia to participate with the May 9th victory parade events. And so, you know, it's almost binary. If you want to be in good graces of the ruling establishments in Europe, you have to be anti-Russia and you have to be committed to Project Ukraine. But publicly, it's extremely unpopular, and it's increasingly difficult to maintain this, especially now with the U.S. administration letting go of it. I don't know how it ends. I hope it doesn't go to the level of civil wars, but we will see social uprisings. We will see social revolts in Europe, and I don't know how that will reflect on the political process. We see that there's more and more and more repression by the ruling establishment against the people, mostly in Germany and the UK. In France, not so much, because you know, the French people are very, very, you know, they don't have a very high tolerance for nonsense, and they are very prone to protesting and causing disruptions. But definitely, Europe will have to find its identity. Europe will have to find its way forward, because the situation as it is now is very, very unsustainable, and either it will be overcome through the institutions of the system, through the political process, or there really will be revolutions and civil wars.
You remember when there was a presidential election in Italy during the Biden administration, and everybody was talking about Meloni coming to power, how would that change the unity on the part of the West toward the conflict in Ukraine? And I remember there was an interview on CNN with the, I don't know, Finland has a president or prime minister. It's the head of Finland.
I think he's the prime minister.
He's the prime minister of Finland, said that the interviewer, if I'm not mistaken, was the, he asked the prime minister of Finland, "Are you afraid of Italy, Meloni coming to power?" He said that they're not going to do anything because they're in debt, and they know what they would face if they go that way.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Is that still, you know, the case for Italy?
Well, you know, Giorgia Meloni is very close to the Trump administration. She's very close with the certain U.S. interests which seem to be opposed to Europe, to the European Union and to Britain. This is all, you know, happening under the radar. It's not overt. It's not out in the open, but it's very, very real. And I think that we will know. It'll take time for the dust to settle and for things to become more apparent. Right now, it's very, very difficult to judge. Again, part of the reason is that, you know, there's a lot of entrenched thinking. You know, people on both sides of the Atlantic have grown up with the ideas of these traditional alliances between the United States and European powers, the special relationship between the Britain and the United States and all this. But I think that in actual fact, the relations are borderline hostile now. And if you read British press, every so often you will see hints dropped that the United States is now the enemy. And then, you know, not the Europeans in the sense of European nations, but the European Union is very afraid of Trump, and they are on unfriendly terms. And then there's the thing of Denmark, which, you know, will come to a breaking point over Greenland at some point. I think that the United States has now explicitly embraced multipolar integrations. which means that the current administration sees their future as part of the multipolar world, which means that they have to make nice with Russia, with China. I think that the tariff war is a wrecking ball to dismantle the current system of free trade and force a renegotiation of trade relations on a bilateral basis, you know, with China, with Russia, with other countries, in a way that's different from the British free trade system enshrined under the WTO. But I think that the long, in fullness of time, that's going to be the future. Of course, this is the United States shifting from the British free trade system to the American system of political economy. Which is, you know, the difference is that British free trade system is allocating credit to speculative activities, not to productive industry, and then running these boom-bust sequences, inflating financial bubbles, speculation, bursting the bubbles, obtaining massive bailouts for the too big to fail banks, rinse, repeat, all over and over and over again, where, you know, the nation, the population, the industries, the small and medium sized enterprise always loses, and the bankers always walk away with the loot with complete impunity. The American system of political economy is more centered around a state-controlled bank that issues credit for productive uses, meaning infrastructure projects, reindustrialization, reviving of the small and medium-sized businesses, and so forth. And, you know, the change is so radical, it could hardly be more significant than it is. And in fact, it's, you know, this change between the two systems, this contrast between the two systems goes back to two centuries. You know, Abraham Lincoln's economic advisor, Henry Carey, formulated this very explicitly in a book called The Harmony of Interests. I published a section from his book in my last Substack article, which lays this out. And as it turns out, all eight U.S. presidents who have been either assassinated or mysteriously died while in office have been proponents of the American system of political economy. So this is really a huge, huge deal. And obviously, the Trump administration is going to face very powerful pushback from those segments that have been privileged with the British free trade system that has pretty much ruled since the Bretton Woods time, and has also seen the U.S. deindustrialize since the Bretton Woods time. And if we look at the United States today, it's a shadow of its former self. And Trump has on several occasions said very explicitly that he wants to make the United States the manufacturing powerhouse of the world again.
Alex, you've mentioned the case of Palestine, Gaza, when we started this talk. And here is the Mahmoud Abbas, PA president, Palestinian Authority president, demanding Hamas release captives to remove Israel's excuse for war. Is he really that much? I don't know what word can I use, that much dumb, that he believes
a Quisling, a traitor Quisling of the Palestinian people? Yes, he is. Yes, he is. That's obvious. He is the outsourced arm of Israeli security state. They have simply outsourced their repression of Palestinian people to Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. So yeah, that's my take on Mahmoud Abbas. But you know, he's still there. He's still there in the West Bank, and obviously he's doing Israel's bidding. That's to be expected.
Do they not see what's going on between Israel and Lebanon, between Israel and Syria? What's there that Israel is bombing them, attacking them? And it's not just about captives and hostages and prisoners. It's something beyond that. But these people are so much, they're trying to simplify everything. In their mind, I don't know, as you mentioned, maybe he's just working for Israel and whatever Israel wants, but after all, he's responsible because of his position. And people can see what's going on. They don't need these people to interpret what's going on.
Yes, but you know, somehow this system of repression in the West Bank has been entrenched, and now, you know, it'll take a real uprising to change things. And I think that things are increasingly moving in that direction. But at the same time, I think there's also Israel has come to the position where it seems to be disintegrating. The Israeli government, there's more and more recriminations, more and more fighting between the factions. Apparently, and I think Alistair Crook said that either I think on Judge Andrew Napolitano's program, he said that 60% of Israelis now expect that there will be a civil war breaking out in Israel. Well, you know, if you're sitting on the other side of that, then the one thing you don't want to give the Israelis is external enemy that would cause them to close rank behind Netanyahu's government. Because you know, once there's an external enemy, an external threat, then all these internal infighting dies down because you have to go and defend the nation. So I think that maybe that's part of the reason why so many forces in the region are standing back. You know, Iran still never replied for Israel's last attack, because maybe they judge that it's better to let Israel just fall under the weight of its own internal problems.
Here is, Alex, here is the article in the Israeli, about the Israeli opposition. And here is what he said, Yair Lapid. In the red line has been crossed. If we don't stop this, there will be a political murder here, maybe more than one. Jews will kill Jews. This is the situation right now in terms of what's going on between Netanyahu and the Shin Bet chief. Israel is not feeling that much comfortable as the way that Netanyahu is trying to picture. I have just decapitate, assassinate. He says that Israel was capable to assassinate the head of Hezbollah, Hamas, and they're having the upper hand right now. But when you look at Israel, it's much more divided than ever. But you don't see that much this, what's going on in Israel, that much being explained in the mainstream media in the West. It seems that they just don't care what's going on in Israel. They're just so much focused on the axis of resistance, and they have been defeated, they have been weakened, they don't see what's going on, what Netanyahu is doing and has done to Israel so far.
Well, yes, but you know, as far as the mainstream media in the West is concerned, you know, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. It's a guarantor of stability in the Middle East. It has the right to defend itself, and that's about it. That's about all they say. In Israel itself, I think the debate is a lot more lively, but it's also becoming a lot more polarized. And another Israeli politician said that Netanyahu should be removed from office by force. Many people may have thought so, but now it's being said out in the open explicitly. So it's telling you that the situation is untenable. And I think that the stage of decay now is such that it may be irreversible. And I think that in its current form, Israel can no longer survive. It'll have to change. And I don't know how it's going to change, but I think that, you know, Henry Kissinger's prophecy from 2012, when he said that in 10 years, Israel will no longer exist, is maybe now coming to pass. It's been more than 10 years, but it's happening. What's going to happen after that? We don't know. The two-state solution has been killed by Netanyahu largely. And so what's the alternative? A one-state solution. So it will have to be some kind of a state not based on theocratic racial supremacy of one people that get to oppress the rest, but it'll have to be a nation where all three constituent peoples will have equal rights, some form of democracy where Jews and Christians and the Muslim will have equal status. And I hope that something like that will happen, and that the region will then finally know peace, because Israel has been the empire's attack dog in the region. It has kept the region destabilized for 77 years. And maybe this now comes to an end. I really hope so.
Alex, the negotiations going on between we had the second round of negotiations between Iran and the United States, which were positive, despite having those sort of rhetorics on the part of Witkoff. If you remember, he said that Iran has to stop its uranium enrichment, but they didn't. It seems that they didn't talk about it in the second round, and it was just something for the media, nothing for the negotiation, as far as we know. But when you look at the position of the United States today in negotiating, talking with Iran, Saudi Arabia, China and Russia tried to somehow help the United States in JCPOA. Saudi Arabia was against Iran, was against any sort of agreement with Iran, JCPOA. And they were so vocal about it, talking about it. And right now, for the case of Saudi Arabia, we had the defense minister of Saudi Arabia going to Iran, carrying a letter from his father, the king of Saudi Arabia, to the Iranian leader. And they're talking about not only they're agreeing on any sort of talks and settlement between Iran and the United States, but also they're prepared to make a new security for the region together with Iran, new security architecture. These are huge changes that are happening. Saudi Arabia, which before, many people are arguing, by the way, they're condemning Hamas, that Hamas was responsible for this and that, but Saudi Arabia was on the path of getting closer to Israel. If you remember, before October 7th, they wanted to make an agreement and just bury the case of Palestine, just everybody would. But the situation has totally changed. It's not in favor of Israel. The region is feeling that the Iran and Saudi Arabia, at least from what we've seen so far, they're feeling that they're closer together. I talked with Professor Marandi in Iran. He said that right now, Saudi Arabia is concerned about what's going on in Syria, what's going on in Lebanon, and that's why they're getting closer to Iran. This is so strange to me. for someone who is witnessing what, who was following what's going on between Iran and Saudi Arabia, in your opinion, what's going on in the region? And is that going to be considered by the Trump administration?
Well, so far as Trump administration is concerned, you know, it would appear that they are ardent Zionists, that they are all completely and totally committed to Israel, that they are an Israel-first administration. But that is completely inconsistent with them embracing the multipolar integrations, because Israel has been the project of Western Empire. It was created by the British Empire. It was created there as a beachhead to keep the region destabilized in order to defend Western hegemony over the Middle Eastern region in order to be able to extract its resources and keep control. That means that you have to be policing the region. You have to be supporting Israel militarily. You have to defend Israel no matter how complicated, how expensive it gets, because it's the banker's access to the collateral of the Middle East, so that it's an asset on their books. Okay, so that doesn't make a lot of sense, that, you know, United States embraces multipolar integrations, but at the same time completely committed to Israel. I think that the reason that this, and so, you know, if I were Israeli, if I were a Zionist, I would be very, very distrustful of the Trump administration, regardless of what is being said out in the open. Now, I think that for the UAE, Oman, Saudi Arabia, I think they all see the writing on the wall. They all see that the situation is unsustainable. They all see that if they yield to Israel and to the Western Empire, that they'll be next. You know, this is no security architecture. This is a permanent insecurity architecture. And, you know, up until 10 years ago, I don't know, on my clock it's 2015 when Russia intervened on the side of Syria in the Middle East, that things begin to change and the powers in the region realize that there is an alternative. And then there were several very important moments that I think probably shook the regimes in the region out of their slumber. One of them was August 15, 2021, the United States withdraws from Afghanistan. I think this was a very significant moment because it showed to everybody that the empire can no longer defend its puppets, because we saw Afghanistan's president hastily board a helicopter with bags full of cash to escape with his life, and also the governor of the central bank trying to run to Turkmenistan, to Tajik, I don't know where, and then he ended up, you know, he was rejected, and then he had to fly to Dubai, where they kind of let him stay reluctantly. But what it showed to these regimes is that empire can no longer guarantee their security. So they might end up hung and quartered by their people. So now it means we have to make nice with our own people. We cannot take them for granted anymore. And it also means that we might have to find alternative protectors, you know, and alternative guarantors of security. So, you know, this vacuum was filled by Russia and China. I think that Russia initiated the peace talks between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and I think that China saw them through to their completion. And now I thought for a very long time, much before all these events happened, what is the reason for Saudi Arabia and Iran to be enemies? And I think that the only reason is because that's the way it was set up by the British Empire. And those hostilities will be maintained. And you know how they maintain them? They make sure that there is no effective communication between the two sides. Like now, they're desperate to break the new Entente Cordiale between Russia and the United States. You know, they want to keep them on hostile terms. So the same was done between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And now there's no need, there's no more need for that. And there's a lot to gain from constructive cooperation. And now everybody sees that. And then, you know, Russia signed a comprehensive cooperation agreement with Iran. China signed a comprehensive cooperation agreement with Iran. They're holding annual naval exercises every year in the Indian Ocean, right there in front of the Persian Gulf. So I think that's a very, very strong signal to everybody in the region that the security architecture is being overhauled. China has pretty much designated Iran as the region's anchor of the new security architecture. And so now people, and then another important moment was the West freezing Russia's assets in Western banks. And so many of these oil exporting countries have hundreds of billions of dollars sitting in European and American banks at the Federal Reserve and in London and in Europe. And they now realize that that money is not their money. You know, this could be frozen and taken away from that. If they can do it to Russia, of course they can do it to UAE. They can always invent some kind of UAE is a center of money laundering. We're going to impose sanction. We're going to freeze your assets. And then that's it. And so they realize that they need something else, that they need to protect themselves by making nice with Iran, with China, with Russia, and so start to distance themselves away from the Western Empire. But the same is going on in the United States. And I think that the tide is really turning. And this is why we see now that the main arsonist of peace in the world, which is the United Kingdom, is starting to destabilize more and more and more regions. I got a report from Bosnia that, you know, the president of the Serbian enclave, Serbian canton, Milorad Dodik, is going around with very heavy security, and he's saying publicly that the British are trying to assassinate him, specifically the British. And in pretty much everybody in Bosnia accepts that the British are ruling the land and that the place is crawling with British secret services. And then, you know, we had this terror attack in Pakistan, which, you know, could precipitate a wider conflict between India and Pakistan again. And so, you know, I think that the Western Empire is in a dying agony, and it's going to try to set the world on fire to preserve itself. But at the same time, I think that the powers that are opposed to them understand what's going on. You know, they're no longer falling into provocations. And I think it's getting much, much harder for them to do what they've been doing for the last 200 years.
Alex, when it comes to China, we know that the United States is interested to get out of Ukraine, I would believe from the Middle East, and go to China, then to what's going on in Taiwan and the situation with China. Here is what Marco Rubio said in terms of how they're planning to deal with China.
Number one challenge on every front that I can imagine, geopolitically, national security, economically, industrially. And look, the president says this all the time, and I agree. We don't blame the Chinese. The Chinese have done what we would have done if we were the leaders of China. Previous leaders in this country and around the world allowed them to cheat and steal and get these unfair advantages, and they took them. Why wouldn't they? But now it's got to be fixed. It's got to be fixed.
Nima, I've never been a fan of Marco Rubio. To the contrary, I had a certain contempt for the man. But what he said there is exactly correct. That is That is probably the most perfect statement Marco Rubio has ever said in his life. This is exactly what happened. I think that the history of the rise of China goes back to the 1971, when Richard Nixon severed the convertibility of the dollar to gold. And I think that from that point on, the ruling establishment in the West knew that they were going to destroy the dollar and the United States, that they were going to completely deplete the host. They're going to kill the host. And they would need a new hegemon in the world to enforce their system of, you know, system of free trade, system of colonial plunder, and, you know, name it what you like. And they designated China as that new colonial hegemon. And so this is why they built up China into this economic powerhouse, except it didn't work out that way. But along the way, they did make everything possible to build up China at the expense of the United States, among others. And so this is exactly right, where when Marco Rubio says the Chinese have done what we would have done if we had that, if we were put in that role. Exactly. The Chinese have simply gone along with that because it helped them to build up China into the economic powerhouse that it is today. But they wouldn't have been able to do that if the Western powers didn't help them along, the Western financiers, you know, who counted on China being their new enforcer. Except, you know, as it turns out, the Chinese have, they drew them in, but they were not intending to become their global cup. They intended to draw them in order to behead them. But it's true that, you know, the United States has lost a lot of industry at the expense of China, and now they want to reverse this. They want to rebalance this and bring back manufacturing to the United States. But this will have to be sorted out between the United States and China in bilateral trade talks, and you know, they will have to be signing comprehensive bilateral cooperation agreements, as the Chinese did with the Russians, as they did with the Iranians. And there's a lot of complementarity between the Chinese economy and the American economy. The American economy still has a certain dynamism that will allow it to spring back. You know, when you start to allocate credit, not into housing bubbles and real estate bubbles and you know, spending trillions on the military industrial complex and bases and keeping, you know, upkeeping the NATO and so forth, the United States will be able to allocate a lot of capital into its main industries, into reviving the small and medium-sized businesses. And, you know, the United States is still the leader in certain technologies. It's also a leader in certain industries that maybe go under the radar, but, you know, I always like to point out, you know, if you want to buy a Rolls-Royce piano, it's going to be the New York-built Steinway piano. And, you know, they have things like, you know, Fender guitars, and, you know, Hollywood can still make nice films, you know, once they sober up and purge it from all these degenerates that are running it. But, you know, the United States has a lot to offer to the world. And so I think that that's going to come back. I believe that you know, there's not going to be a war between China and the United States, and I think that so unless Trump ends up dying mysteriously while in office, and you know, the global interest managed to regime change and bring back some autopen administration, Juan Guaido maybe becomes the next president of the United States. I think that the United States will continue to go in the direction of multipolar integrations. And so that's something that everybody should look forward to. I understand that there's still a very strong, suspicion of Trump. But I think that we have to understand that what he's doing is so radical that it has to be done in a certain covert way, and that their moves have to be so unpredictable that they always keep their opposition kind of unbalanced. And then, you know, the stuff in the Middle East, which is deeply disappointing, it is what it is, but I'll have a question for you after this. If I were a Zionist, I would be deeply distrustful of the Trump administration. Anyway, the question I wanted to ask you, Nima, I understand that some of the recriminations among the Israeli government officials has to do with resupplying humanitarian aid to Gaza. Do you know about this?
Actually, I don't see that would be... I don't have any sort of information on that. But
no, okay, because I have some information. I don't know if this is real or this is rumored, but if it were real, I would like to know where the pressure was coming from.
Yeah. But Alex, the problem, Alex, the other important point, by the way, I do believe if Donald Trump can reach an agreement between Iran and the United States, that would hugely benefit Gaza and the situation in Palestine. It's unbelievably influential for the situation in Palestine. And on the other hand, we don't know, Alex, what's going on beneath the surface, but what's at the surface, we see Netanyahu not that much criticizing Donald Trump for what he's doing, as he was doing during the Obama administration. We know how harshly he was criticizing Obama for JCPOA and going against. And we see the Trump administration filling with all Zionists around him, but at the same time they have just they're somehow trying to manage the situation with the negotiation. And if Donald Trump, we are all disappointed with what's going on in Gaza, because this is not just in Gaza, with Lebanon, with Syria, and Yemen is trying, nobody but Yemen is trying to fight Israel. But it's all about a political game. We have to see the bigger picture.
Yes. Yes, I agree with you, Nima. It's possibly one of those situations where in order to win a battle, you risk to lose a war. So, you know, you step aside. With regards to Netanyahu, I think that he's standing on such thin ice that part of his shtick is projecting the image of close alliance with the U.S. administration. You know, to prop up his own power and his own standing in the Israeli society, he's not criticizing Trump because he wants to project that, hey, you know, Trump and I were like this, you know, so he's behind me all the way. So you all there, you know, make peace with that. And then from Trump's side, you know, if the day Benjamin Netanyahu falls, there's no telling what's going to happen next, but there is a certain likelihood that Israel falls into anarchy, into chaos, and civil war. So I think that as far as the U.S. administration is concerned, it's the devil, you know, rather than chaos that you cannot predict how it plays out, and then you know, it could scuttle a lot of plans and create a lot of problems that you're not ready to deal with. I don't know. It's the situation is so severely complicated that it's hard to judge. I'm very encouraged now with the new military cooperation between China and Egypt, which creates a real counterweight to Israel. And I think that, you know, little by little, we're moving towards a permanent peace in the region, which is very, very hard to imagine because it has been a festering sore for so many decades. But, you know, the source of all this is always the same imperial center, which has exactly set it up for that purpose when they created Israel, when they drew those Sykes-Picot borders as they did. And so this is now in its dying days. And obviously, you know, it's going to be ugly until the situation settles. But it's coming to a new day. It's coming to a new dawn.
Yeah. The way the fall of Assad in Syria, it doesn't seem to be that much. It's going to have huge, huge influence on the region. And you see Saudi Arabia talking to Iran, concerned about Syria, which somehow surprising for the people who knew that Saudi Arabia was one of the main sponsors of Daesh and Al Qaeda, all of that. And right now they're afraid of HDS in Syria. In Lebanon, they want to somehow close the government in Lebanon to Hezbollah. They want to just make some sort of agreement between, they're interested in that. These are important changes.
Yeah, these are very important changes, but I don't think that that's going to work, because I think that even people in Lebanon realize that if you remove Hezbollah from the government, then Lebanon becomes the next target for Israel. You know, they're basically pressuring Lebanon to disarm themselves, to make themselves sitting duck for Israeli aggression, and then everything they're doing in Gaza, everything they're doing in West Bank, they're going to be creeping up higher and higher north. And you know, they're explicit about it. This is part of the Eretz Israel. You know, this is what they want. So I think that. Well, you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago, when the United States was the undisputed hegemon in the region, everybody would have to bow down and do as they demand, maybe. But today, it's really no longer the case. And I think that with respect to HDS, I think these people are dangerous for everyone, including Russia, you know, because this is exactly who the groups that have perpetrated terror attacks in Russia, who have tried to destabilize Russia in Dagestan and Chechnya, who can still draw recruits from those regions and from Afghanistan and from Syria and from China. And so I think that everybody in the region sees that if this faction, as long as this faction remains alive and powerful and funded, they are a risk to everybody.
I think it's so much delusional to think that Hezbollah gonna disarm, and it's beyond and I don't see the government in Lebanon that much stupid, that much dumb to ask for that, because if they ask it, they are nothing less than Mahmoud Abbas in the Palestinian in the West Bank.
Exactly. They will become the PLA in Lebanon. And then, you know, the Lebanese people are going to suffer a similar fate as Palestinians in the West Bank. And I don't know why, you know, we don't hear much about Jordan. I can't imagine that Jordanian king is having a good time these days. I don't know how long his regime is going to last there.
They're talking about Muslim Brotherhood. Right now they're so much afraid of what's going on. It seems that they're feeling the influence that the Turkish government has in Syria and the rise of Muslim Brotherhood, not only in Syria. The concern comes from Egypt and how they can influence Egypt in a long run.
Yeah, and the fact that the Chinese are now beefing up their military cooperation with Egypt is a strong signal that they're countering those winds.
Alex, before wrapping up this session, here is a question one of our audience asked you. Yeah, can you read it? Alex, what's your prognosis of the new upcoming military partnership between Hungary, Serbia, and more potential allies? Will this further shatter EU, allowing countries to pivot to the east?
That's a very good question. Thank you. I think that, yes, this is definitely a defense against the empire's dark arts, you know, if I can say so. You know, the Western powers, it's always coming from London, unless it's coming through its satellite, Brussels. They have pushed Croatia into an alliance, into a military alliance with Albania, Kosovo, and Bulgaria. And I'm not sure if Bulgaria is really a part of it. People are saying, no. They're denying it, even though it's been officially announced. This is the east, the south, and the west of Serbia. This is obviously aimed at Serbia. But there is zero appetite for this kind of a conflict in Bulgaria. And there's zero appetite for this kind of a conflict from Croatia. So we're talking basically about Kosovo and Albania. And I suspect that Albania is not too much on board with that either, because Kosovo is a NATO-controlled enclave, a U.S.-controlled enclave. But again, you know, the United States is rapidly losing interest. It used to be, it still is a training ground for jihadis that then get fielded around to Syria and elsewhere. To wage war on behalf of the empire, and now there's fear that the Serbs will retake Kosovo, and that the Kosovo will have to defend itself by force of arms at some point. And then at the same time, the Serbs have refused to sanction Russia. They have good open cooperation with Russia, and so attacking Serbia would be again like in World War One. A way to draw Russia into another quagmire, this time in the Balkans. And in World War One, they used Serbia to provoke Austrian Empire into attacking Serbia, waging war, and then it all blew up because Russia had to come to the aid of Serbs. They didn't come to Serbia, but they declared war on Germany because Germany was deemed as responsible for the behavior of Vienna. And so now it seems to me that the Brits are trying to revamp the same playbook to draw Russia into the Balkans, to defend Kosovo as their beachhead in the Balkans, and to prevent Serbia from taking it over. But I don't know that it's going to work because Serbia, Croatia, even though we were at war against the Serbs 30 years ago, we actually have a lot of reasons to have a positive, constructive cooperation with Serbia. You know, we were part of the same country once. We had our disagreements, but we speak the same language. We are Christian nations on both sides. On the other hand, Croatians have very little in common with Kosovo or with Albania. We are completely different peoples. We don't speak the same language. They're Muslims. We're Catholic. Dragging us into this alliance is something that's almost against nature. Not to mention that it's territorially not even contiguous. These are territorial fragments that are not even connected. So it's the whole plan, I think, is completely idiotic. 100 years ago, Hungary was a major European power. Croatia is not a major European power. It's like the whole thing, it's the same geography, but the circumstances have changed so much that I think that it just reflects the desperation of the empire to do another arson attack against peace in the world. But I don't see it as gaining very much traction. In Croatia, in fact, people are kind of thinking like, what is this? What kind of an alliance is this? What does this have to do with us? And it's almost like it drifted into oblivion because people just kind of dismissed it. Like, whatever, this is nothing, never mind. And so I think that nothing comes of it. I think that these the Balkans is going to be very difficult to set alight again. It's not impossible, but it's going to be difficult. I think that people are seeing through the British role in Bosnia and against Serbia, and I think that they're not inclined to play into it.
There are a lot of similarities between the case of Iran and Iraq and Croatia and Serbia when you mentioned.
It's always the same playbook, Nima. It's the same playbook. And now, you know, Pakistan against India again. And it's just like one thing after another. This has been the 200-year architecture of insecurity in the world, deliberately set up, deliberately fomented by the British Empire and its reincarnation with the U.S. NATO Empire. But it now faces real opposition in this world, and I think that real opposition is not only in command of the bulk of global GDP, it's also a credible economic, military and diplomatic power in this world. And I think that more and more and more nations are realizing the sun is starting to rise from the east again, and they're, you know, it's forcing rethinking.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us
always today. A pleasure, Mima. Thank you very much. Take care. Until the next time. Bye.
See you. Bye-bye.